It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest picked up the cello after a 25-year hiatus. He tells the story of learning new things at a later age and joining the Late Starters Orchestra.
First, we're about an hour away from kickoff at Team USA's first match at the 2014 World Cup. They'll be playing Ghana, a team that has knocked them out of the championship twice.
Team USA may be going in with some baggage when it comes to their opponent, but their new German coach has shaken things up, and the team looks pretty different from past years. Here with us now is Wall Street Journal reporter Matthew Futterman. He joins us from Natal, Brazil, where the U.S.-Ghana match is set to start within the hour. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So some of the soccer I watched yesterday looked like they were playing in the rain. I've heard there's a lot of rain down there. How is the weather right now?
Well, I'm in Natal at the stadium where the U.S. is playing tonight. It's very humid. Clouds have come in. Looks like it's probably going to rain later. But it depends on where you are. In the north and the northeast part of the country, it's been quite hot and humid, and there has been a fair amount of rain. Further to the south, it gets a little cooler and a little more comfortable.
How does rain affect the way tonight's game might be played?
Well, it just makes the field very slick. And, the fields actually have been holding up pretty well in the rain. They're not falling apart. They're not becoming mud fields. They really are holding up pretty well. It just makes it slick. And, it probably favors the more precise passing team because the ball will move very quickly. And if you're good at passing like that, that could help you.
So tonight's game, U.S. plays Ghana, not necessarily a soccer powerhouse, but it sounds like they've been the bane of the United States lately. How has Ghana gotten in the way of the American team?
Ghana is just an incredible, is a very athletic team. They are very driven, of course. I'm not saying the U.S. isn't driven, but in the last two World Cups, they've really just sort of outworked the U.S. in a way that I think has sort of surprised them. They also have this terrific striker, the captain Asamoah Gyan. I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but it's something along those lines. And he really rises to the occasion in the World Cup. He certainly did last time, and I think all indications are he's really in top form as we head into tonight's game.
Ghana has been a roadblock for Team USA. Do you get a sense from following the American team that this is a team they're worried about based on past experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they talk about Ghana in a different way than you heard them. I remember 8 years ago heading into games and they were supposed to play Ghana, and you would hear them basically say, well, Ghana, they're fast. And that was about all you heard about them. But now, they've experienced getting beaten by Ghana twice. It senses, they're fast, they're athletic, they're smart, they're physically very tough to deal with. So, I think Ghana, you lose twice in a row at big tournaments to a team, and they get in your head.
Hmm. So what you just listed, Team Ghana's strengths, what's the Team USA strength, their style of play, too?
Well, I think what's really made Team USA better in the last 4 years is that they've become a much sort of faster, more attack-minded team. I think that heading into the last World Cup, you sort of knew the U.S. was going to be physically strong and try and put up a pretty good defensive front, but they weren't going to be a team that was going to be coming at you from all directions. Under Jurgen Klinsmann, their coach, he's really tried to get them to think in terms of, attacking with 11, defending with 11 is what he likes to say, although the goalkeeper doesn't do much attacking. But, really sort of flying at opponents and bringing defenders up to join the attack, and it's a great deal of speed and movement. Those are the things he emphasizes.
But emphasizing attack like that and bringing defenders up, is that going to give Ghana and other teams openings if they get caught out with too many people up front?
Yeah, it certainly could. You have to do it. You got to do it strategically. You got to figure out where to exploit your tactics, and you also have to have, one or two people assigned to always be keeping an eye on who is going up, and have that person make sure to stay back. In the past few games, the U.S. has really been relying on Kyle Beckerman to do that job, to sort of provide a security blanket in front of the defense, and he's allowed the other midfielders, the more attack-minded midfielders, to go up.
For those not that familiar with the U.S. team, let's meet them a little bit. Who are a couple of the leaders on Team USA?
Well, I mean, it starts with Clint Dempsey, who is the captain of the team, and he's, you know, the most prolific goal scorer for an American in the English Premier League history. He scored 23 goals playing for Fulham a few years ago. But, you know, Clint is not exactly the most rah-rah guy. He's not sort of the classic commander either on the field or in the locker room. So there's a bunch of players who have really sort of filled that void and filled that vacuum. And I think the most obvious thing that, you know, even a non-soccer fan will see when they watch this game is that Michael Bradley, the central midfielder, is easy to spot because he has a shaved head in the middle of the field. He really sort of runs the team, and he's always barking instructions and telling people where to go and really sort of quarterbacking the attack and getting people back on defense.
Who, if we're going to score any goals tonight, who are the most likely suspects to put one in?
Well, you know, the U.S. does much better when Jozy Altidore, the striker, scores. Jozy plays in England and had a really rough season, and he's playing for the club Sunderland, which is a pretty bad club. And, you know, by the end of the season, he wasn't really on the first team. He came out of his slump against Nigeria in the final friendly. And scored for the first time in months. So, you know, if he scores, that's a really good sign for the U.S. He scored a bunch of goals for them last summer in the qualification tournament. And, you know, that's someone you really have to look towards. After that, you know, they can get goals from Michael Bradley. They can get them from Clint Dempsey. They can get them from Fabian Johnson, who has been playing in the right back position, but has become an incredibly aggressive player and can make rushes and actually put goals in the back of the net.
A lot of the talk before the World Cup was a player who's not going to be playing, Landon Donovan, one of the better-known names, left off by Jurgen Klinsmann. Was this a big controversy in the soccer world, or did people in the know think it made sense?
You know, it was a big controversy in the soccer world, and people in the know were up in arms about it. I think a lot of them have been covering Donovan for a lot of years and has gotten to know him and sort of, you know, seen him as something of a security blanket. I would not put myself in that camp. The little I saw of Donovan in the friendly against Mexico back in March and then in, you know, clips of him in training camp is, you know, he just looks slow and overweight, or at least, you know, heavier than he had been. And, you know, not quite there. Jurgen Klinsmann believes in youth and speed, and wherever he can get youth and speed, he's going to make that decision. And you can make that decision to go with those traits. That's what he went with in 2006 when he was coaching Germany, and I think that's sort of his playbook this way.
To move on in the World Cup, the U.S. has to come out of Group G. People have called it the Group of Death. What is so deadly about Group G?
Well, you have Germany, who is, you know, penciled Germany into the semifinals. That's been pretty much the story of the World Cup for the last, I don't know, half century or so at this point. Germany is just a real consistent powerhouse team. As we speak, they're up 2-0 against Portugal. Then you have Portugal, who is playing with Cristiano Ronaldo. He is the best player in the world. As simple as that. Now, he is hurt a little bit. He's had sort of a bum knee of late. But he is he's just the most dangerous player on any field. After that, you have the U.S., who's the best team in CONCACAF. They won the qualifying tournament. And then after that, you have Ghana, who's arguably the best team from Africa. They went to the quarterfinals in 2010, really should have been in the semifinals. They missed the penalty kick in the final moment. That would have sent them there. That's about as strong a group as you'll get in the World Cup.
Do you think the U.S. is going to make it out of this group?
I actually do think the U.S. is going to make it out of this group. I sort of believe in Klinsmann. I think the players have come to the point where they really believe in Klinsmann, and they really seem to believe in themselves. It's the most obvious thing in the world to say that, you know, they have to win this game against Ghana to get out of the World Cup and get out of the group, and that's probably true. But this team seems to be in the right form at the right time. They're very healthy. They don't have injuries to any of their key players. And that's a lot of the battle at the level where they are in international soccer. If you can come into this tournament feeling good about yourself, and they won three games ahead of the tournament, and they won the qualification tournament in their region, in what's called CONCACAF, North and Central America and the Caribbean, that's about all you can ask for.
And as you've described the two teams, win or lose, it sounds like it could be a fun match to watch.
Yeah, I think it is going to be a fun match to watch. I think all the World Cup games so far, most of them at least, have been fun matches to watch. I think that's been the greatest thing so far during this first group of games. It seems like this idea of attacking fast-paced play has really taken over of late, and it seems to be a reaction against the kind of very possession-oriented, somewhat defensive style of play that had been really mounting in the World Cup over the last 20 years. They were only scored, I think, about 2.7 goals a game in South Africa in 2010. And if you think about it, that's just not very many goals. And look, it's not just Americans. People everywhere in the world like to see goals when they watch games. That's just, that's exciting. And I think you're going to see some goals today.
Matthew, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
We've been speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Matthew Futterman about Team USA's first match of the World Cup against Ghana. He joined us from Natal, Brazil, where the teams are set to kick off within the hour.
As we learned in The Lion King, the circle of life moves us all, and this month marks the 20th anniversary of The Lion King, which at first seemed like a really cool benchmark, and then it just made me feel really old. What about you, Rob?
I was old enough to not pay attention when it came out, and I didn't have kids yet, so most of my Lion King experience was, it's an old DVD that the kids can watch years later. So it's not as much of a milestone for me. It made you feel old, though.
It did, but you know what? It's good music, so yeah. I can live with that,
right,
as I'm sure our next guest can as well.
Yeah, it's the circle of life and why it's never too late to begin again. Our next guest lists his profession as journalism professor, author, and very amateur cellist. He picked up the cello after a long break from the instrument and soon was practicing with the orchestra, the New York Late Starters String Orchestra.
Ari Goldman joins us now. He teaches journalism at Columbia University. His new book is called The Late Starters Orchestra. Ari, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thank you. Thank you. Good to be with you.
So how did you get into playing cello the first time around? You've had a renewal of that interest, but back in the early days, how did you first fall in love with it?
Well, I couldn't stop listening to the cello. It just was the instrument that jumped out at me. It was the instrument that I heard when I listened to an orchestra. It was the one that connected to my very being, and I wanted to play it, but I was busy with life. I didn't have the opportunity as a child. I grew up in a broken home, and music lessons weren't really part of my childhood. But in my 20s, I pursued the cello and found it very hard. It's a very frustrating, difficult instrument, especially to learn as an adult. And I played for a few years and then put it away, but kept listening, and saying, someday I'll get to it, someday I'll get to it.
And then what inspired you then to finally get to it again and pick it back up?
Well, I was turning 60, and a crazy age to try to pick up a string instrument. And I said, I'm going to give it one more chance. And the main inspiration was my son. I have a son who took Suzuki cello and was just, picked it up like it was the easiest thing in the world. And I figured if he could do it, I could do it. And everyone said, you're crazy. My older kids told me, my wife said, everybody said, you've tried this before. We've heard all the bad practice things. Don't give it don't go there. My son, who was then 12, said, Dad, you could do it. And he was then playing with the youth orchestra in New York, and I decided to join the youth orchestra. So I was this 6-foot-tall, middle-aged guy with middle school children. And they were tolerant of me. My son encouraged me. And I played for a season with a youth orchestra as best I could. And then they said, you've got to find adults to play with.
They kicked you out. Well,
they kicked me out. And I live in New York. And to do anything like musical in New York, you got to be good. Even the amateur orchestras have waiting lists and auditions. And then I discovered this orchestra called the Late Starters Orchestra that's made just for people like me who are coming back, who have a dream to play a string instrument and have an opportunity here. And the best thing about the Late Starters Orchestra is there's no audition. If you think you can play, you can play. And I thought I could play. I thought I could play well enough. And they took me in. And that's when my adventure with music began.
Well, take us back to this fledgling attempts when you got it out again at age 60 and you were playing your cello alongside your son. What was it like reconnecting with the instrument? And how bad were you?
I was, when my son was learning and he'd play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, everybody would, you know, stand up and applaud. And, oh, isn't that wonderful? But when an adult plays Twinkle, Twinkle, everybody goes, that's all you've done. That's all you've learned. You're taking lessons and that's all you've learned. So it took a lot of sort of perseverance. And luckily, there's a little thing called a mute you could put on a cello that sort of deadens the sound a bit. But you don't get good unless you keep practicing and practicing and practicing. Everybody, as I said, was skeptical. Even my, we have two little dogs, and they would bark whenever I played. And we live in an apartment building in New York, and the neighbors weren't so happy. But I would take it outside. I would take it, in a play in the middle of the day so as not to wake anybody. And slowly, step by step, I got good enough that I didn't have to be embarrassed and good enough to play with an orchestra and eventually play in Central Park and play at a concert hall called Symphony Space, and step by step got better.
Well, it seems like that's part of what you're trying to inspire. A kid learning doesn't worry about being good or not. It's new to them, and they're okay with that. How does a grown-up overcome that sense of, if I do something, it's got to be good?
That is sort of drilled into us. And I've had a career, as you mentioned in the introduction, I was a newspaper reporter. I was a reporter at the New York Times for many years. Then I came to Columbia University where I teach journalism. So I'm accustomed to doing my job pretty well. And to do something poorly is not, it's not what we expect of ourselves. We expect excellence, or at least expect competence. So when you're at the bottom, you have to think about small victories and taking small steps and playing one piece well. What helps a lot for me was joining a community. I'm the same age as Diana Nyad. Now, she's famous for finally, after four attempts, swimming from Cuba to Florida in shark-infested waters. And when she came out of the water after that historic swim, as the first person to do it without a shark cage, she said, I have three messages. The first is never give up. The second is you're never too old. And the third is that it looks like a solitary sport, but it's a team effort. And playing the cello for me was a team effort. It was playing with others that really got my game up and inspired me and pushed me to do just a little bit better. When you're a soloist, everybody hears every flaw. Everybody hears every wrong note. But if you're part of the cello section, and there are 10 of us in this cello section, and you get some of the notes, and the guy next to you and the gal on the other side gets some of the notes, all together, you amount to something that you can't by yourself. So it takes a team, and that was like the most important lesson for me, that I, by myself, I'm a pretty horrendous player, but when I play with others, it sounds good, and it keeps getting better, and it gives me pleasure, and I hope gives my listeners pleasure.
We're talking right now to Ari Goldman about his new book. It's called The Late Starters Orchestra, about getting back into music and picking up a childhood dream. We continue our conversation with Ari Goldman, author of The Late Starters Orchestra, about picking up the cello after taking a 25-year hiatus and how he got back in it, learned that playing music was a team sport, and is now a cellist.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you done something like this? Gotten back into music in your adult years, maybe picking up the instrument you played back in the school band? Or have you started up in music for the first time ever lately? Maybe you're taking lessons on something you'd never played before. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our phones right now and take Stephen in Janesville. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just been listening. I wanted to say that I played instruments when I was really young, kind of the standard, piano lessons, and I think I had maybe 6 months of guitar in there, but never really got into it. And then just recently, a couple of years ago, I picked up a banjo on Craigslist and started playing that. I took $30 a class at community college. It was really cheap, and now I play banjo, and I'm actually getting all right at it. People don't run when they hear it anymore. So, I guess I just wanted to say that, you know, I've always wanted to play music, and I know a lot of people do, and it's really easy to get discouraged because nobody's good at it at first, and that everybody can be a musician, and 99% of musicians out there are not millionaire rock stars, and you don't have to have fun.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you so much for that, Steve. It reminds me a little bit of another Steve Martin, who took up banjo kind of late in life, too. And Stephen getting at the notion here that music doesn't have to be a spectator sport. You can get into it at any time. What would you say to that, Ari?
I'm thinking about people who are late starters. George Bush, who just jumped out of a plane at 90. To celebrate his 90th birthday. It's not too late to do music. It's not too late to fulfill your dreams, whether it's learning a language or flying a plane or jumping out of a plane. We're living longer. We've added years and years to our life expectancy. And those years should be meaningful, and they should be filled with things that we love and things that maybe we didn't do professionally, but that we can do not just as a hobby, but almost because it's our destiny. We have to play that song. We have to learn how to do something in life that has always escaped us, and it's not too late.
Thanks for that call, Stephen, at 800-642-1234. Ari, you've talked about the destiny of playing cello. How do you feel? What does it make you feel like when you actually take time and play?
It's a special joy that I don't get from just listening. And it's a special sharpening of the mind and of the body that comes from making the music and knowing that it comes from my efforts and from my hard work. It's just something that rounds out my day. I can not think of going a day without touching my cello. Mm. Veronica earlier said, now I'm a cellist. I'm hardly Yo-Yo Ma. I'm hardly good at it, hardly great at it, but I'm good enough. And it has opened up this other aspect of me, and also opened a community to me, community of musicians. It's fun just walking around with the cello. A lot of my friends who are late starters suddenly have this new identity. They're carrying an instrument, and people say, "Oh boy, you must be on your way to the Philharmonic or on your way to Carnegie Hall." When in fact, I'm on the way to the Late Starters Orchestra, which sort of gets by pretty well. And as I mentioned before, we don't audition, so anybody can join. We also don't have concerts because we're not ready for prime time. We do have open rehearsals, so that we play and hope that other people will want to come and watch us rehearse. That means that the conductor may stop us, may correct us, may tell us how to get better. And still, there's pleasure in listening to that, and there's certainly pleasure in doing it.
And we go back to our phones now. Fred is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Fred.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
What are your show?
Thank you. What have you taken up lately?
I've started playing the cornet. I played trumpet starting in the fifth grade through high school, and I didn't play until a couple of years ago. I bought a cornet for $25, and now I play in the Guthrie band, and I just added, somebody gave me a $40 baritone that's a lot of Fenimore, and now I'm playing in Americana band in Dubuque, and we just, anybody can play, and I'm having a blast.
Excellent.
Right.
So what kind of repertoire do you play? You said Americana?
The Americana band, we play ragtime and Dixieland, and with the Guttenberg German band, we play waltzes and focus traditional oopa oopa music.
Excellent. That sounds really fun.
What inspired you to get back to it? Was there a moment or a person?
I was playing accordion in our group, and one of our trumpet players left, and I was like third chair and third cornet, but I started playing and got my lip back together again, and it's been a lot of fun.
All right, Fred. Hope we can catch you out there in Dubuque or Guttenberg sometime. That reminds me of some advice I think you've given elsewhere, Ari, on making that late start. He said he got a $25 cornet. Is that a good way to go? Get a cheap instrument to start easing your way back in?
Either get a cheap instrument or rent, because it's a big commitment to buy an expensive instrument. But if you could borrow one, or even better, find one in your closet. There was the NPR station in New York did this instrument collection program to benefit New York City schools, and they asked people to think about what they have in the attic or have in their closet that they could donate to a school, because kids could learn instruments, and these instruments aren't being used. But a lot of people went into their closet and said, you know, before I give it away, I'm going to give it one more try. And they found that they could still pick it up and play, or they found that maybe it's time to part with this. But sometimes we have things right at hand that we don't have to go out and make a big investment for. A lot of people also told me that they were inspired, as I was, by my children. There was a 72-year-old man in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who told me his granddaughter was in a band and was in an orchestra and needed a violin. So he took his granddaughter shopping for the violin. And while he was there, he said, you know, I haven't tried this since I was in college. I wonder if I could still play. Well, they left the store with two violins. He bought one for himself and for his granddaughter.
Hmm. Well, that's fantastic.
So, kids can inspire us. And sometimes we have the ability to pick one up, or just to borrow one, or to just find one in the closet and dust it off.
Ari, can you leave us with any words of wisdom? I'm thinking about how you were talking earlier about how all the years of our life should be meaningful, even if, you know, we're not 25 anymore. We can do and try new things. Does it extend beyond music?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I made a list of people who started things late in life, and I think they're inspirations. I know that Golda Meir became prime minister of Israel when she was 70 years old. Grandma Moses started to paint when she was 70. Julia Child didn't cook till she was 40. The actor Danny Aiello started acting at 40. So that you don't have to do, you know, your best years aren't only your young years. Noah Webster wrote his famous dictionary at 69, and Ben Franklin invented bifocals when he was 78. So the human mind has this great capacity, and we all too often think learning is for children, that's the time of growth. But as we live longer and as we have exposure and opportunities, we should take advantage and continually learn new things and try experiences that we didn't have before.
And Ari, we heard from Jen on Facebook who says, always wanted to go back to violin or learn viola and cello. Sounds like she hasn't yet. Quick word of inspiration for her?
Go for it. There's you'd be surprised at how much is still in your mind and still in your fingers. If you learn music as a kid, you can access it. It's almost like getting back on a bike. Not quite as easy because you'll find that the chain has rusted a little bit. But try it and try to find like-minded and like-talented people. And that's what I found with the Late Starters Orchestra. They've really brought up my game and gave me a good subject to write about in my new book.
Ari, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your inspiration.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to talk to you, Bob and Veronica.
That was Ari Goldman, author of The Late Starters Orchestra.
We'll look at birds in this edition of Wisconsin Life. In the summer months, a lot of people like to have songbirds in their backyards. While backyard birders may enjoy hosting nesting birds, the birds don't always build their nests in the best spot. Mike Paulus has been fighting his avian neighbors for years now.
I try to see it from the opposite perspective. I really do. I try to sympathize. I imagine myself snuggled in all cozy upon the couch, doing the things I like to do at home. I imagine myself reading a classy, thought-provoking novel while listening to classy music and sipping a classy beverage like instant hot cocoa. Then, exploding from nowhere, I hear bam, 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 and I feel the floor shake over and over again as something huge wallops the side of my house. Before I know what's happening, the house is falling, twirling, end over end as it, me, and 100% of my earthly possessions, not to mention my wife and kids, goes rocketing straight down, crashing into the hard concrete in utter ruin. I try to see it from the opposite perspective, from the perspective of the bird. I really do. But it doesn't help. Something inside me just can't stand to have a bird's nest above my porch light perched directly over the front door to my house, and I just gotta knock it down. Every year in the springtime, the nest appears. At first, I notice stray bits of stringy weeds littering the front step. Little pellets of mud are sprinkled before my door. I look up, and there it is. The foundation of a robin's nest. Just a small, fragile spiral of brown dead grass about the size of a filthy drink coaster. Taunting me. If I knock it down in a fit of preemptive nest annihilation, it just reappears within a day or two. I'm speaking from experience. Like fat, red-breasted ninjas, the robins return under cover of darkness. Instead of nunchucks, they bring twigs. Instead of throwing stars, they bring bird crap, and they fling it all over my step. If you're not diligent, knocking down the nest every time you see it, you will never win the battle. Because ninja robins are tenacious. Every year, I try to be diligent. I want to grab an old broom and poke, poke, poke the nest to the ground. But my wife says, "You can't do that. That's their home." I say, "They will rebuild their home elsewhere, honey. Robins are tenacious." What if that robin needs to lay her eggs right away?" she asks. "They don't have time to build a new nest. What about the babies?" And this is why, every year, I have a family of robins living in a nest stuck to my porch light with muddy nuggets of mud. And this is why, every year, for the majority of the spring and summer months, I'm scared crapless by actual angry birds dive-bombing within inches of my head as I dare to get the mail, wave to my friendly neighbors, or weed my weedy gardens, because I don't want to kill the babies. The robins are just a fixture in our lives now. I assume they're the same robins, season after season. My kids will grow up knowing them as our avian neighbors. Maybe we should give them names. In fact, I already have a few names in mind.
Boom, boom, boom. Mike Paulus is the online editor for the Arts and Culture magazine, Volume 1.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. The series is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find information at wisconsinlife.org.
Switching gears on bird life, we've got a bird expert about how to attract birds to our backyards this summer and maybe the right thing to do if we have some unwanted nesters.
Andy Palios is with us. He's a wildlife biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Andy, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So there are some birds that are really a delight to have in the backyard. I'm thinking right now of oriole season, who have these beautiful flute-like songs. What do we do when we actually want birds in our backyard?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do this time of year, and of course in the spring leading up to nesting season to attract birds. Everything from planting good native trees and shrubs that they like to nest in and find food in, to maybe putting out a little oriole feeder in your backyard.
And what is a good source of food for birds? One that, you know, say an oriole would like, and maybe some that are more broadly appealing to lots of birds.
Yeah, so the songbirds that we all like, mostly this time of year are eating insects. And so whether it's caterpillars or beetles or ants. So that's why having a lot of good trees and shrubs, or maybe even a little wildflower garden, is really important, because most of the birds that we think about in our backyard that we like a lot, like orioles, actually most of the year are eating insects for the protein and not the seeds that we think about in the winter that we feed the chickadees and cardinals and stuff. So,
well, I imagine when you talk about planting trees and shrubs that birds like, you don't want to have a barren backyard with little tiny evergreen bushes. You probably want somewhere that the birds will feel safe, maybe some larger evergreens. Are there any particular plants or shrubs, trees that come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, if you're lucky, someone 100 years ago planted a nice oak tree, and so you can benefit from his or her forethought. But otherwise, I've got some nice spruce trees or some arborvitae in the backyard, and those are good escape cover or a place for a bird to put his nest. But otherwise, you're going to want things like dogwoods or oak trees or hickories, or, I mean, there's so many species of trees and shrubs native to the, you know, Madison area or wherever you happen to live. And there's lots of good resources online or through DNR's website that can help you kind of pick what's good for your area.
Well, we just heard from a Wisconsin Life commentator who wasn't too jazzed about the robin's nest on his house. Are there things we can do to discourage birds from nesting in a particular spot?
Yeah, absolutely. I was laughing at his characterization of his ninja robins. But robins, or we often get a lot of calls about swallows or other sort of birds that build a open cup nest on a platform. If they're doing it in an area like your porch light, or I'm currently looking at a robin in my front deck that likes to put it on our stoop here. You can basically, if you sort of prohibit the bird's access to the area, maybe put a little screen or netting over that area just temporarily, or you can even kind of affix some sort of plastic spikes or something to that area before the nesting season, and then they're going to look for somewhere else to build it. Or you can even, if you're crafty, you can even build a little platform nest and put it somewhere where you don't mind them being kind of out of the way, that kind of attracts them to that area.
What about a big picture of a hawk?
I'm sure the hawk might catch their attention once, but when it doesn't move for the next 6 days, they probably are going to ignore it. So,
so birds are brighter than that. Okay. Well, what about bird bass? Is that a must if you want to have a good bird scene in your backyard?
Yeah, especially in the middle of the summer, especially running water. So folks that have really gone to sort of these sort of solar-powered or battery-powered small fountains are really having good luck attracting birds on these hot, sunny days. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the sound of the water sort of running that sort of signifies sort of cool, clean water that's really, really important this time of year.
Now, as far as bird houses go, what do you do if you've got up your birdhouse and let's say it's a bluebird house, but you've got a cowbird in it? What should you do?
Well, cowbirds, despite their bad reputation, are protected, so you're stuck with them. But most birdhouses that are built are actually the hole is too small, or you can build it so that the hole is too small for the cowbird and just right for the chickadee or the house wren or whatever you want in there. So you got to kind of think ahead when it comes to cowbirds. But
and as far as the birdhouse itself, is there just sort of a basic one that we should think about?
Oh, man, there's so many good designs out there. And it depends on the species, but the Wisconsin Bluebird Association has some great designs on their website of things that have worked well for them. If you're into having a little house wren in your backyard, there's basically any sort of cavity, could even be like a weird ornamental sort of design. You could get creative. The wrens will definitely use it.
As far as sort of the crown jewels in backyard birds, what do we hope for if we're really going to get lucky with the birds we have?
Yeah, well, if it all depends on sort of the neighborhood you live in, but if you're in the city, you know, the real crowd pleasers are probably things like Baltimore Orioles, or in migration, maybe some rose-breasted grosbeaks, or even the, you know, pretty northern cardinals that are fairly common are quite striking birds and great songsters. So those are some of the most common backyard birds that people really like to attract.
And lastly, what about seed? Is there a basic seed you recommend when we're starting out?
Yeah, I mean, it just depends on the time of year. So I usually feed seeds mostly in the winter and in the spring when the seed eaters are kind of overwintering or migrating through. And the tried and true seed is black oil sunflower seed. It seems like most of the birds that we love really, really get a lot of good energy and nutrition from that food.
Okay, black oil sunflower seed. Sounds good. Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Andy Palios, wildlife biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, talking about ways to attract birds to your backyard.